You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. What can your data tell you? With Google Cloud Platform, use machine learning at scale to build better products. It predicts so your business can thrive. Click now to learn more about Google Cloud Platform. Visit g.co/getcloudai. Again, that's g.co/getcloudai. And now, enjoy the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. I'm sure you've heard the old cliche, men are from Mars and women are from Venus, and although the best science seems to indicate that guys and girls are still in fact from the same planet, breakthroughs in neuroscience have revealed that the sexes have very different brain chemistry at play, which might be at the root of so many marital spats and misunderstandings. Neuroscientist Luann Brizendine wrote about it in a 2007 best-selling book, The Female Brain, which analyzed brain scans to show how various hormones influence how a woman processes information and makes decisions. The book, which has sold nearly a million copies and been printed in 30 languages, was an eye-opening revelation for many women, including comedian Whitney Cummings, who says the female brain changed her life. So much so that she decided to bring the female brain to an even wider audience by making it not just into a movie, but a comedy. And today she comes on the podcast to talk about the humbling experience of being a first-time director, how she learned that every moment doesn't have to be a joke, and why she says the female brain isn't just for the ladies. In fact, according to Whitney, she's practically handing men the cheat codes to a happier, better relationship. She shares how she broke free of a cycle of codependency once she started understanding the neurochemistry behind her bad choices, and why she says it's a lot harder to come up with jokes when you don't have all that nonstop drama. Whitney weighs in on the Me Too movement and hints that the new Roseanne reboot, on which she serves as executive producer, might just help us better understand how Middle America went for Trump. Plus, Whitney on being a lady comedian in the Middle East, women who see Marilyn Monroe as a feminist hero, and how she almost accidentally killed Sofia Vergara. Coming up with the hilarious Whitney Cummings in just a moment. I've got the hilarious Whitney Cummings in studio today. She just wrote, directed, and starred in a new movie called The Female Brain, which opens in theaters February 9th. Whitney, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you.
Whitney Cummings, you are a busy, busy lady these days. You've got this new movie. You just put out a book a few months ago. Now you're, I think, the lead writer on Roseanne, if I have that right.
And not the lead. No. Executive producing it, which maybe seems like a very fancy title, but no, there's so many amazing. Every writer on it is a lead writer, but I definitely get CC'd on more emails than some of them.
Yeah.
It's kind of the only difference.
With all this on your plate, are you still finding time to do stand up at all?
Yes, I wasn't really able to when we were in pre-production for Roseanne, and when I was on the book tour, I did some stand-up, obviously, because I was the part of the tour. But I'm now, with what's going on in our news cycle and our zeitgeist, it's like the only place I really want to be right now. So yeah, I'm working on a new special for Netflix that I'll film in a couple months.
Oh, terrific. You know, that's interesting that you talk about what's going on in the zeitgeist, because I don't typically think of you as someone who's necessarily, I don't want to say topical, but like into current events, talking about like the election and stuff like that.
Yes, and you're right. And I'm so not that person that I didn't even think of that when I said zeitgeist. I was sort of thinking more about what's
going
zeitgeist. On. Yeah, exactly. My own personal zeitgeist.
When you get famous enough, you get your own personal zeitgeist.
That's amazing. They're expensive.
Yeah.
So I'm thinking sort of more in, I guess, the area that I'm fascinated by at the moment, and that I think we're all sort of living in, is just sort of with the Me Too movement and with Time's Up and sort of the tectonic plates that are sort of shifting before our very eyes in terms of people listening to women and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I wonder, as you go around promoting this movie these days, are you getting asked about hashtag Me Too and that whole movement a lot in interviews?
I think that, you know, I haven't done a ton of press yet, so we'll see if you do. Maybe this okay. is a tricky way of asking. You know, I think the most interesting part is when you make an independent movie and then you get lucky enough to get a distributor. And I got an amazing, you know, just to do this movie with IFC is just so cool, because I'm such a fan of the titles that they choose in doing an independent movie. And, you know, this was a very down and dirty, gritty movie. Like, we used my dogs. I had to take a picture with a toilet and post it on Instagram so that we could get it for free. I mean, it was a grind, and a lot of things went wrong. Sofia Vergara's trailer had rotten food in it, and she almost got killed by a chair. I almost killed Sofia Vergara. I mean, it's been tricky. But then, you know, you sell the movie and then you get a release date. Mm-hmm. And every filmmaker, I would assume, wants the movie to come out as soon as possible, right? Because you want people to see it as soon as possible. You want the jokes to feel fresh and topical. You want the outfits the actors are wearing to actually be in style. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, they were like, well, we're going to release it in 6 months, or there was just some hold up with it about waiting to release it. And I was like, oh God, I'm a comedian. I want immediate gratification. I want it now. And it's kind of coming out at this amazing time, at the perfect time, even though 6 months ago, I never would have thought that this would be the conversation people were having. So for the movie to come out right now, I think is really kind of poignant and perfect and cool.
Yeah, I mean, I'd be interested to have you weigh in on that, since it's up, since I brought it up, actually. Like, I mean, you know, based on your comedy, I'm interested to hear your perspective on the Me Too movement, because you seem to kind of make a distinction between real feminists and pseudo feminists.
Oh,
you know, the
have
people
I
who worship Marilyn Monroe and that kind of thing.
Oh, right. Did talk about that on a show. No, I mean, it's more, I think, like, you know, I just think it's important that maybe people understand that, like, not all women are the same and not all men are the same, you know? So this whole thing of, like, all men are bad, that's not what that's certainly not what I'm saying, you know? I think that the bar for men is actually high, because there's a lot of really great ones. So when certain ones do gross things, we're like, what are you doing? Why, you know? And I think the same goes with women. I'm hearing a lot of people go, like, women are just, you know, capitalizing on this thing, or they're it's McCarthyism, whatever the complaints from the other side are. I'm like, but not all women are the same. So to generalize about half the population is a little crazy. So I think that when one man does something wrong, we can't assume all men are like that. And when one woman does, we can't, you know. So I think, you know, I was just sort of joking about Marilyn Monroe, and, you know, I love Marilyn Monroe. I'm a big fan, but she's turned into some, like, feminist icon who's constantly in my Instagram feed as this. I love Marilyn Monroe. I'm very pro woman, but, like, I think we have, what about Ronda Rousey or Oprah? Or, like, you know, I just feel like she's not in my top 20. You know, and so I think that it's a really exciting time, because there's so many amazing female role models, and I'm always sort of obsessed with role models and who kids can look up to. And, you know, there's some amazing ones right now.
But I mean, Gloria Steinem or Madeleine Albright are probably better role models for a woman than Marilyn Monroe.
Monroe wanted to be. I think we've unfairly cast her as this sort of,
that's true,
you know, feminist icon. I think she was like, I was just, you know, like the quotes that I was joking about where she's like, make a man wait for 2 hours. It's like, that's an asshole. Sorry, I don't know if I'm allowed to curse on this.
Go for it.
I don't support that, you know.
That's nothing to aspire to.
Make yeah, making men wait is rude and it's not something to aspire to. So I think it's just important that, you know, equality also means women, you know, and I call my friends out and they call me out where I'm like, no, you can't do that. That's hypocritical. You know, we have to be able to have a sense of humor about it and check each other sometimes too.
Yeah. I mean, the one that really gets me is I always see this one pop up on my Facebook feed, the quote or the meme that says, if a man can't handle me at my worst, then he doesn't deserve me at my best. First of all, like, what is her worst? Was pretty damn bad. And like, what's her best? Like a day when like some married man finally returns her call and she doesn't puke on herself.
Totally. Like, and yeah, she was allegedly. I hope that her estate doesn't sue me. But yeah, she was like, you know, she. I think she was up against a lot and had a rough childhood. And I have lots of compassion for her. But yes, I think this we and look at me generalizing, I just try to not conflate entitlement and empowerment. And I think being mean to men is not what we're going for. I think the idea is just equality and fairness, not superiority and, you know, punitive action and making men wait. I don't think that's kind of feminism I'm trying to be a part of.
Before we went on mic, I know that you were saying that you're getting ready to do a new stand-up special. What I've heard of the Maryland bit and you just kind of extemporaneously going off.
Yeah.
Does that make it into it?
I think it might. Has it fleshed out
into a bit by now?
It's making me super uncomfortable to talk about, which means I have to make it a bit. But I think that's where a good bit usually comes from. You're like, I don't know if this is going to piss people off or I need, you know. So that's usually when I get excited about something or I think there's enough meat there to make a bit about it. And like you going, this is on my Facebook feed. That means it's...
People get it.
I think people get it.
They understand what you're talking about.
And, yeah, and it's somewhat incendiary, and she's kind of sacrilegious to make fun of her in any way. But you know, I think that, you know, I think it's unfair, like how we tend to make athletes role model. Like they're not asking. Mm-hmm. You know, we're all flawed, and we all make mistakes. And to, you know, put a celebrity on a pedestal and make them a religion, I think is always going to be dangerous.
At some point, I heard that you were the first woman to do comedy in the Middle East, like in Dubai and Beirut.
I've heard that too.
I guess
it's true. If the internet says it's true, I don't know if that's fake news or not.
Okay.
But you know, I wrote a little bit in the book about hearing that. It feels a little bit like it could be just slightly blasphemous because I'm sure there's women that have done it over there, but there's just no one reporting about, you know, I don't know. But
either that or they got stoned to death.
Correct. Something horrible.
They're not with us anymore.
Totally. So I did go over there maybe about 10 years ago, and it was really fascinating. I wrote all about it in the book because I realized how wrong I am about so many things. And, you know, going to a world that's very different than yours, you realize all of your egos and your preconceived notions and your judgments and your self-righteousness and all that. So it was very fascinating.
And you talk a lot in your act about how you used to struggle with codependency and had all these crazy stories about these losers that you used to date.
Right.
But then you saw a therapist and worked on yourself, and now you're at a good place and working on this film and the book and everything. There's this stereotype that comedians have to be addicts or some kind of a hot mess to be funny.
Yeah.
So I wonder, from your perspective, is it harder for you as a comic when you have your act together and you don't have this steady stream of drama to draw on for new material?
That's an amazing, amazing question. And I worry about this every day. You know, I said to a friend of mine recently, I was like, but what if it's like if I get... You know, if I'm too together mentally, like maybe I won't be funny anymore if I get too sane. And he's like, you don't have to worry about that. you have plenty of crazy in you, you know. But yeah, I do think that the sometimes the most interesting work comes from our pain and our mistakes and our vulnerabilities and our bad decisions. And I think that our flaws are what make characters interesting. That's what makes for great story and great tension. And, you know, I definitely have no plans for making fewer mistakes moving forward. That's kind of a part of life, you know. But yes, I think that might be every comic's fear of, like, if I get sober, if I get healthy, if I get into a good relationship, I won't be funny anymore. But I think for me, it's thankfully been the opposite. Because I'm not in dramatic situations anymore or painful situations, at least not on purpose, I have a lot more energy to write and perform and you know, everyone's like, how did you do all this year? I'm like, I think I just had time because I wasn't in a bad relationship. It frees up your schedule.
I mean, do you even feel the need to do stand-up? Because, I mean, there's that idea that, like, stand-up is some kind of a salve or some kind of a way to vent Great. All of your problems that you're dealing with. Do you maybe feel like now you've got your shit together, so I don't need to go out in front of an audience?
It's an amazing, amazing question. You know, I think for me, I think that I almost need it more now because, but I know that that is the case for a lot of comedians. You see them get happy and comfortable or they get money and then all of a sudden they're not doing stand up anymore because the wound is not there that needs to be healed. But for me, I think working in network television and doing a movie, especially where you have so little control of what's going on. I mean, it's like the weather, people get sick, they get late. I mean, it's like the thing, it's so out of your hands so much that I think after making a movie and feeling like a controlled train wreck, I love doing stand-up because it's the you can there's no one saying cut, there's no one saying you're running out of money, there's no one saying this actor's
the immediate reward
and then you know where you stand and you know what the truth is. So especially in trying to figure out, you know, all this stuff about what's going on with the news and am I right, am I wrong, am I, you know, is this sexist, is that wrong, what's right, going on stage and just talking to the audience and taking their temperature and feeling the pulse of their reaction, because we're so wrapped up in message boards and at replies, like just feeling the energy of real human beings in real time. That's where the truth is, you know. There's no fake news, there's no manipulations, there's no Photoshop, there's no Instagram filters. It's just human beings connecting to each other and figuring out what it means to be human. And that is such a, I feel like I need that more than ever now.
And I feel like I noticed some bits that make it into this movie. There's stuff that I've seen in your stand-up kind of in some incarnation make it in the movie. So if people like your stand-up, they're bound to love this movie.
Or Neil Brennan's stand-up.
Because
we wrote it together and a lot of his stuff is in there too. So it's sort of both sides of that.
Were there a lot of cases of your material, the things that you joke about, like Crocs and stuff like that, making it into the movie?
That's so interesting. You know, I think as a comedian, like when you've seen roomfuls of people laugh because of a joke, the temptation is to go, okay, this works. Yeah. I should put this in this movie or I should put this in this tweet or this book or whatever. So yeah, I mean, certainly when you're on set and you're trying to figure a scene out and it's not working or it's not, something's wrong with it, I definitely have an arsenal to pull from that's like, this worked 100 times. I have a feeling it's going to work the 101st time in this movie.
Yeah.
So you have some sort of reliable go-tos.
Yeah, but I imagine it can also be a double-edged sword because as a comedian turned writer-director, is it hard to control that impulse to just make everything a joke and just steamroll over the heartfelt moments with lots of big laughs in
a
movie?
Great, amazing, amazing question. And I just sort of learned this or was able to apply this lesson that I did learn on Roseanne. Because Roseanne was a show that had, it was an incredibly funny show, but not every line was a joke.
Right.
And the amount of restraint that you use on that show is fascinating. And I try to use the same in movies of like, you don't want every line to be a joke because that's not how people talk, especially couples that are in pain and hurting and mad at each other. They're not like coming in with hot zingers at each other. So, you know, I'm very proud that a lot of the movie is inherently funny situations instead of unfunny situations where actors are saying jokes to each other like on a, you know, sitcom. So I really ended up going in post, you know, Neil and I went in and we took out a lot of jokes.
Oh yeah.
In post. Huh. Yeah. Because it was like there was the actors did such an amazing job. I mean, that's what's fascinating about doing a movie. And you write the script and you're so happy with it. And then the actor comes in and acts it so well that you realize like the look he just gave makes these next two lines unnecessary or redundant. Mm-hmm. So you end up just like cutting. If you get good enough actors, you cut a ton of stuff. You know, like James Marsden came in and it was like his eyes were saying everything. So we just the dialogue just felt extra. It felt gilding the lily almost in a lot of his scenes or the Blake Griffin and Cecily Strong. Some of the funniest stuff was just them looking at each other. And, you know, those moments where you are trying to anticipate what the other person's going to say and you're fighting with your forehead, you know, like these moments where you're like, oh, God, don't ruin it with dialogue. You know, so I think when you get an amazing cast, you end up having to cut a lot of jokes.
Well, you described the female brain as a neurology comedy. Mm-hmm. For those not familiar with the genre,
it's not a genre. There's comedy. No other movies in that genre. Maybe like Magic School Bus?
Maybe there will be.
I hope
you're
so.
Pioneer.
I mean, it's interesting. Like, I remember I read the book and and it's such a big effect on me. And then I'm asking all my, I'm like telling everyone, I'm like, you got to read this book, The Female Brain, you got to read this book. And everyone's like, we've read it. And I'm like, this is like, I'm the last to know. And then I realize how successful the book is. And I'm like, oh, this should be made into a movie, because every successful book gets a movie, right? The Gone Girl, Girl on a Train, da da. But when it comes to nonfiction, nobody thinks to do it, I guess, or, you know, maybe.
Especially non-narrative nonfiction.
But if it's been proven to be popular and people are buying it, they're obviously interested. There's got to be some kind of interest there. And I think that a lot of people, you know, in Hollywood operate from like audiences are dumb. I think the opposite. I think audiences are smart. TED Talks are getting 40, 50 million views. People want to edify themselves and they want to learn. And so I was just trying to figure out a way to, you know, make it informative and smart and funny and educational, but still super entertaining.
I mean, that's pretty challenging probably for a first time director. Yeah, I would have thought that you would have found a spec script or something, or adapted a novel. Made it easy on yourself.
I think that if you care about something enough, you can push it across the finish line. And the key is with a movie, because we spent almost 4 years from beginning to end on this.
Wow.
And God knows how many more years are going to come, after. But the sequel, The Male Brain, or we were joking the other day, now we have to make The Female Body. But, you know, you have to love it, because there are times where you really want to give up. There were times where I wanted to give up. The Rain Machine has two speeds. Did you know that? On?
I didn't know that.
Okay, Off and Tsunami are the two speeds of it. No one told me that, and it ruined a whole take. And there's just days that you're just like, want to give up, and it seems like it's too hard, and Sofia Vergara almost dies in a chair, and you're like, I'm killing one of the biggest TV stars on the planet. But if you love something enough, and if you're, this sounds so cliche, but if you're passionate enough about getting it out there, you can survive it. Because independent filmmaking, I watched Lost in La Mancha.
You have to be passionate.
You have to. Literally, what got me through it was to be like, I want my future daughter and son to be able to see this movie. You know, like I wish I had this movie when I was 20 to demystify my brain and my boyfriend and my girlfriends and whatever. And like, that's what got me through. It was certainly not the big payday or the, so I just had to find something that I was ready to throw myself on a sword for.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with Whitney Cummings when we come back in just a minute. What can your data tell you? With Google Cloud Platform, use machine learning at scale to build better products. Google Cloud's AI provides modern machine learning services with pre-trained models and a service to generate your own tailored models. Their platform is now available as a cloud service to bring unmatched scale and speed to your business applications. It predicts so your business can thrive. Click now to learn more about Google Cloud Platform. Visit g.co/getcloudai. Again, that's g.co/getcloudai. And now, back to the podcast. Now, what did the neuroscientist Luann Brizendine, or however you say it, Brizendine?
Brizendine. It only took me 4 years to get that right.
What did she say when you said, hey, I want to turn your science book into a movie?
It's so funny because she's not in the movie business. So she was super excited and not jaded. Like, it was so funny to be like, we'll make a movie. We want to make a movie. She's like, that's great. When are we going to make it? And I was like, oh, you really think this is going to happen? How cute. Most movies never actually get shot. They never actually get distributed, So it was actually really a positive influence on me, because she's like, okay, so here's what should happen with the script, and here's what should happen with the brain. And I kept going like, she actually thinks we're gonna make this.
You found yourself an easy mark.
How naive. So her positivity and sort of complete lack of she doesn't have that, her spirit's not crushed from our business. So to be around
That's
someone
a wonderful endorsement of Hollywood.
Yeah, right. Welcome. Really was helpful to me, because she was so wide-eyed about it and so excited, and she was amazing. She taught me so much, and she was so clear with me and explained things to me in a way that I could actually understand, so that I didn't make a fool of myself.
Yeah, because you kind of more or less play her in this movie. Your character is sort of based on her, I guess.
It's based on her, and I just wanted to, because I sat down with her and I just assumed she was going to be like a nerdy neurologist. I don't know where I even got that stereotype, but I went up to Sausalito where she lives and spent the day with her, and she was charismatic and funny and smart and not anything that I anticipated. And I was just like, oh no, like you're like Julia Roberts. Like this is not the dramatic tension that I needed for this movie. So I'm going to have to like take some creative leeway here. So it's not what she's actually like.
Right.
She's
right.
Actually way less awkward than I am. She's more socially adept than me. So, but she was super helpful and I would call her all the time and be like, is it the amygdala or the amygdala? What is, how do you spell this? Is it phenylethylamine or oxytocin? You know, she's constantly sent. And then she would send me these like JPEG, like pictures that just looked like a Jackson Pollock painting. And I was like, this is not helpful. I'm actually more confused, you know? So she was really patient with me.
Give us some examples of stuff people might learn in this movie, The Female Brain.
Something that was super fascinating, you know, to me is developing an understanding of when you produce adrenaline and cortisol, you know, basically when you get anxious and when you get stressed, which is what I hear a lot of people complaining about now. I'm so stressed, I'm so anxious, you know, whatever. And essentially, there's something called epigenetic imprinting, which when I read about this, it blew my mind, which means whatever neurochemicals are being produced when you're in utero by your mother are chemicals you're going to be born addicted to, like how a crack baby is addicted to crack, right? So if your mother is very stressed out when she's carrying you, you could be born with an adrenaline addiction, which means you go through your life sort of gravitating towards stressful situations to get that hit of adrenaline that is your equilibrium. So that blew my mind because I grew up in a chaotic household. If you have lots of siblings, that's a stressful environment for a mom. And I was like, oh my God, my mom when I was in utero was probably so stressed out. No wonder I'm always in these dramatic situations, you know? And so that was really fascinating to me. And then I learned that you can actually lower your tolerance for adrenaline so that you stop craving it, stop getting, because adrenaline turns into dopamine. So
interesting.
That's also fascinating because we get stressed. And then you actually produce dopamine after, you actually feel good. So on some level, we're sort of addicted to stress. It's the same neurochemistry as cocaine or smoking weed or anything. Because my narrative was like, I hate stress, but I secretly kind of loved it. So that was an interesting thing to get into. I wondered why when I was in writer's rooms or, you know, in work environments with lots of people, how I had a harder time saying no. And I had a harder time disagreeing with people. And there's all this amazing research about how women, and this is not a men versus woman movie, because it's very much about nature versus nurture. And women can have traditionally feminine qualities. Men can have traditionally, you know, females can have traditionally masculine qualities. Like there's no, it's all stereotypes and it's all social constructs. But females tend to avoid conflict because when we lived in tribes 2000 years ago, if you're pregnant and vulnerable, you need everybody to like you and protect you basically. So when you're in a group, your instinct is kind of like to create harmony, but that's a reptilian brain instinct that worked 2000 years ago. We don't need it today because we aren't living among lions and we aren't naked pregnant on a, you know, in the desert. We have alarm systems and we have, you know, police officers or whatever. So that was really interesting to me. And it's kind of like liberated me and helped me to fast forward from primordial times and be like, oh, I can disagree with this person and this, I'm not going to get eaten by a tiger if I do that, you know, and it just helped me to put in perspective. It's like everything that drives you nuts about your boyfriend or girlfriend or husband or wife today probably would have saved your life 2000 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we're just running around with this sort of old neural wiring that is meant for survival that we just kind of don't need anymore. And if you learn about it, you can kind of dismantle and deactivate a lot of it.
But still, even if you know these things about your brain, even if you know your brain's going to try and make me do this, you can't override the brain. The brain's still in charge. So like, how do you actually put that into practice in real life?
That's a great point. Yes, that's the daily struggle. You know, there are some really interesting facts of like, you know, it takes 28 days to make a new neural pathway.
Right.
So like the same way if you're quitting smoking or you're quitting alcohol or quitting sugar or whatever, there's going to be a chemical, you know, there's going to be an aftermath for like, so, but I'm like, I'm trying to lower my tolerance for adrenaline. So I literally had to do like 28 days, no adrenaline. Like I tried to like, you know, I wasn't working
you
on
just
anything.
Avoided drama?
I tried.
How do you do
it? It was not easy. But I worked really hard to like not take stressful phone calls. Like I told everyone in my life, like I'm taking a little break. You know, like I really had to treat it the same way I would treat quitting a chemical addiction of a pill or, you know, anything, and just weaning yourself off it so that your tolerance is lower. You know,
so
I quit.
How did that work when you decided to direct a movie then?
Yeah, then I relapsed and was completely off the grid, and I was in fight or flight mode.
Okay.
For about 2 years. So it happened actually kind of, I tried to do it before the movie, and then I had to do it a little bit after the movie. But that's kind of what like meditation is in your building new neural paths. I try to do twice a day. I don't always make it 20 minutes.
Really?
Twice
I'm trying.
A day. Even if it's 10 minutes, even if it's just closing your eyes and, you know, going crazy, you know, that's still that brain rest thing is a big deal, I think, mm-hmm. for us, and I think should be like mandatory and in like teachings and schools and stuff. The fact that we're not taught to take care of our brains in any way, you know, and you're taught to stretch, you're taught to shower, you're taught to brush your teeth, but no one's teaching us how to care for the most important organ in our bodies. And so I do that because, you know, I learned that you build new neural pathways between your amygdala and I guess your hippocampus when you meditate. It builds those. The ability to calm yourself down.
Yeah. I had Dan Harris, who has this new book about meditation. Yeah. He came in the other week. And so he's kind of been keeping on me to stick with it as much as hard as it is.
Do you think there'll be a day where, like, we look back now and we're like, can you believe people used to, like, smoke on airplanes? Like, we look back. Or, like, can you believe there used to be, like, children worked in factories? Do you think there'll be a day in, like, 20, 30 years where we look back and we're like, can you believe companies used to not have meditation breaks? Like, I think that might be coming.
I think so. I mean, I was surprised that he was telling me that like the military now is doing all these studies into meditation. It makes sense because if you have some guy who's under this amazing amount of stress in Afghanistan and people coming at him and stuff, having a clear frame of mind must be incredibly valuable. So, yeah, I feel like that and other institutions are starting to actually say, okay, this isn't just hippy dippy bullshit.
Right.
There's
totally
a practical application. So maybe.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, I don't know. It feels like there's something starting to really happen.
Yeah. Now, the title of this movie might be a little bit misleading, The Female Brain, because it also contrasts men and women's brains in a very useful way, I think.
Yes.
There's good relationship stuff in here. It might even make a good date movie.
Yeah.
How does a girl sell her guy on taking her to see a movie called The Female Brain
instead of
Thor or The Last Jedi or something?
Do you want the cheat codes? Like, do you want, you know, I think that
it's a good incentive.
It's interesting. You know, I guess the title, because it was already an actual book, I wanted, you know, we always wanted it to be honest with what the movie was about. The male and the female brain is a very weird title for a movie. You know, I know because I used to go on stage and ask people, have you guys read a book, The Female Brain? So many guys would say yes. You know,
interesting.
Yeah. Like, because they want to, you know. I think guys, maybe more than women, want to know, like, what do you want? Why do you act like this?
Yeah.
You know, if you want to know why your girlfriend is always trying to pop your zits and pull out your ingrown hairs, if you want to know why she wants to check your phone and can tell when you get a weird text, why are you acting weird? Or you just gave a weird look. No, I didn't. Yes, you did. If you want to know sort of the biological basis for a lot of the behaviors that seem very confusing to you, that baffle you on a daily basis, I think this should be like homework, I think, for guys. I know so many guys when they came in, we do focus groups where you show the movie to a bunch of strangers, and in the comments, guys would just write, thank you, like, finally, now I understand, you know, why my girlfriend's so neurotic, which is, I don't think his girlfriend's neurotic, personally, not that I know her, but I think that a lot of this movie is about reframing these stereotypes that both men and women get. You know, it was men are stupid, women are crazy.
Yeah.
I don't think either of those things could be true. So it was the idea to reframe, you know, that, you know, you think women are crazy. No, they're sensitive, and that's actually a good thing. And let me explain why it was imperative for our species to proliferate. She needed to be that way, you know. So I think it's just reframing and trying to challenge stereotypes about everyone.
Yeah, guys do throw that around all the time. A woman's crazy. I had
psycho.
One friend. Yeah, he would, every time he broke up with a woman, I'd say, what happened? And he'd be like, oh, she went crazy. But ironically, she would always go on to something really successful. Like, she'd be like, oh, she has a jewelry line in Nordstrom's. Or movie's in Sundance. So she would go crazy, crazy successful, I guess.
Yeah, totally. Like, in the
but
more
to him,
you ask,
she's nuts.
Completely. And I think that there's this sort of stigma against being emotional or having feelings. Mm-hmm. And I think we're really seeing it right now with what's going on in the news in terms of sexual harassment, you know, which is now starting to go towards more areas than just Hollywood in terms of women speaking up. And I think this is a great time to really learn and listen about this stuff, because I think for a reaction to be like, oh, they're crazy, they're emotional, is like the not being on the right side of history, maybe. Yeah. So I hope this maybe helps with that conversation.
And, you know, the industry is still, even today, so male dominated, whether it's the production executive, the money people, any of the gatekeepers who actually decide whether a movie gets made or not.
Yeah.
What was it like for you to go into these boys' clubs and try to pitch them a movie titled The Female Brain?
It's glad you asked that. I didn't even think to do that because it seemed so far-fetched. I met, there was one financer I was going to do it with who was a guy who had tested the title and said the title tested so well. He was just like a money guy and he just was math, you know?
Kidding.
And I think he understood. I remember him saying, like, women buy 80% of products in America. You know, like, we should make movies for women. He was just purely business. And that fell through. And then the next person I met with was a female financier and producer. And she was like, let's do this. And so we made it happen. So I'm grateful that there was a woman who did support me.
Now, as a director, do you have any particular influences or favorites?
Oh, wow. That's a great question. Yes, I have so many. This is such a weird... I really like a lot of dramatic directors. I love Darren Aronofsky.
Oh,
I love Paul Thomas Anderson. I love precision. And I think comedy is about being so specific. Like, there's so many comedy directors I love, but I watched a lot of drama as a kid, weirdly. And the timing of it is so Stanley Kubrick. It's like every frame was picked so specifically and everything was there for the right reason or a reason to confuse you, or, you know. So I'm obsessed with directors like David Fincher and the way that he works. I don't work like that at all. but just I feel like give other directors permission to be really meticulous and anal about the technical side. I'm really anal about the technical stuff, but then when it comes to the actors' performances, I'm like, play and do what you want. I got really good advice from...
That's smart. That's how Hitchcock operated.
Really?
It was Grace Kelly or someone was just torn up that he wouldn't give her any direction, so she thought he hated him. And he said, you know, basically, if you're doing something wrong, that's when I'll talk to you.
I'll let you know. That's fascinating. I had a director do that once too, and I was like, why aren't you saying I'm doing a good job? And he was like, I'm saying let's move on to the next shot, which means you did a good job.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm not your dad. I cannot give you all the compliments that you needed as a child. But yeah, so I think that, you know, Jason Bateman actually gave me very good advice. He said, just cast the right people.
Mm-hmm.
Just cast the best people you can find. You know, casting is one of the biggest jobs a director has. And I was very, very lucky and about getting amazing actors. And we have amazing actors. The key is to just get out of their way and protect them from any fires that are starting or drama. So that's really what I tried to do.
Yeah, the cast is great. You have Sofia Vergara, James Marsden, Blake Griffin.
I know.
I didn't know he's acting now.
He's
who else?
So funny. It's actually frustrating and annoying. Cecily Strong from Saturday Night Live, I really like to, and, you know, I'm not the first person to think of this, I really like to cast people in kind of surprising parts and see them do something they haven't done. So Sofia Vergara is doing a lot of dramatic work in the movie. Blake Griffin is doing comedy. Cecily Strong is doing drama. Like, it's kind of an interesting, I think you guys will be very surprised. Dion Cole is doing drama. He's a comedian. So and Toby Kebbell, who does drama, is doing time doing comedy. You've seen him play apes in action movies and like he's always playing like a superhero or some amazing dramatic. His work in Black Mirror was amazing, and he's really, really, he's like Tom Hanks in the movie, so it's cool.
What was the biggest lesson that you learned through trial and error on this movie?
Oh, God. so many lessons.
I feel like I'm traumatizing you.
I am. I'm
you
like
back
having,
there.
Yeah, I'm having fun. I've learned so many lessons. I mean, oh, gosh, I don't want to embarrass myself too much, but, so many things. clean out the trailers before the famous actresses get there. Get the rotten food out. check the stability of the chairs. Sophia sat, I saw this chair and it was broken and I saw it for like 2 weeks. And I was like, someone should do something about that chair. Someone should really do something about that chair. And then I just, 2 weeks later, Sophia just fell through a chair. I'm like, the chair, I should have moved that chair.
I hope you guys were insured.
If something, who knows? I can't, maybe I'm getting
a
bill.
It's an indie film.
It's, exactly. I think this is maybe going to be cliche, but for me, it was really learning to trust my instincts in terms of, you know, letting someone go if their energy is not healthy. You know, I tend to talk myself into things sometimes. If, oh, no, but she's trying and he's doing a good job. He's nice enough. You know, sometimes you just have, sometimes when you let someone go or fire them, it's the best thing for them also in some way, but also to protect the other people who are doing a great job, you know, just to be able to be decisive and to be able to stand up for yourself and just being able to be the bad guy and be okay with some people are going to be mad at me and that's fine.
Yeah, and there's so much more that's riding on your shoulders in a movie than on a TV show like Roseanne or like Two Broke Girls.
Yeah,
I mean,
like
it's all on you.
You don't want to make a movie, you know, that you're not proud of and go, but at least that person likes me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? At least that person I'll never see again thinks I'm nice. That's just not, you know, so I think it's really on, there can be drama on like behind the scenes of a comedy, which was shocking to me. Because I'm like, we're making a comedy. This should be fun all the time. And that's just not possible. So I think for me, it was just being able to hold my space and, you know, say no without worrying that people were going to be mad at me. It wasn't going to make the scene less funny. Really trusting your gut and figuring out what really matters, like, you know, lose the battle to win the war type thing of just like really picking, you know, not obsessing over the color of a pillow for an hour because it's the grand scheme of things. It just doesn't matter that much. And if I get a bunch of comments of people complaining about the pillow colors on the movie, I retract this statement.
I'm going on Reddit right after
totally. Don't. So it's like sometimes like instead of obsessing over the color of a blanket, maybe go eat lunch. You know, just figuring out what's the best use of my time and being decisive is, you know, a tricky one, but just trusting your gut. And
how's it been working on Roseanne?
Amazing. I've learned so much. It's, you know, I think after, you know, I wrote about this in something, so I'm sorry if I'm being redundant, but I think after the election, we're all sort of trying to make sense of what happened. And I think this was kind of, like you said, I don't really do a ton of political stand-up. And I think for me, working on this show was part of me figuring out the circumstances that led to this is what...
That's what I've been wondering about, because I remember the original show. And I mean, Roseanne and Dan probably would have been the Trump voter. White, blue collar, disaffected, lower income.
You're exactly right. And although the show is not about Trump... his name is never said. Yeah. It's not about him. It is very much about the circumstances that led to people thinking that he was a good choice.
Interesting.
And I think that's kind of an interesting area. And to be able to be in a room with people trying to figure that out in an honest way, I think it would have felt false and weird to have some new working class family on TV addressing this stuff. I think because this family has earned your trust and is in our hearts and kind of under our skin, I think it's, you know, kind of a more digestible way to dig into all this stuff in a narrative fashion with, you know, people we trust and actors we love and characters we love and the couch that we love and the wallpaper we love and, you know,
in pillows,
in the pillows that are the perfect. I did obsess over those pillows because I had to be perfect. So I think it was, I think a way that I could be of service and, you know, I've learned a lot.
Yeah,
and I really wanted
to
learn like how to make a, because there's sitcoms are, it's an interesting time. Like, you know, the networks just picked up a ton of multicams, but there's this dissonance between what America likes multicams, but critics don't for the most part.
And it seemed to me like a year or two ago, like everything was going single camera.
Yes.
And now suddenly there's this nostalgic revival, I guess.
But it's like, yes. And I think I was just trying to figure out like when the multicams were great and critics love them too, like Roseanne or, you know, Will and Grace or Friends.
Yeah.
What were they doing differently? And so I really wanted to get in there and learn. And I think for Roseanne, it's the writers approach it like a play.
Yeah.
They don't approach it like a let's see how many jokes we can jam into 20 minutes. It's how do we tell the truth here, and what's the most human moment, and what's the most satisfying, and maybe cut that joke. And obviously the actors are, you know, Chuck Goodman and Laurie Metcalf, and you also have that going for
the
you.
Whole original cast.
Yeah, so I was just kind of trying to figure out how to, what the secrets were for making a great multicam.
God, I'm so excited to see that. I can't wait. Before we go, I have this crazy theory that I always float by just about every comedian that comes on the podcast, which is, this is just my random thing.
I
believe that every person at some point in their life should have to do a 5-minute set
at
an open mic night. I think that it would
open
up their mind. They'd learn about themselves. Half the people shoot it down. Half the people seem to think it's a
good
idea.
Love it. Love the idea.
Honestly?
Why do people shoot it down? Because they're just like, to be a stand-up, you have to be a stand-up.
Because they think that you have to be a masochist to want to be a stand-up.
That's not wrong.
Self-loathing stand-ups say that, I guess.
I don't think that's – I mean, you know, I think for me, it's the – what it did for me, at least, because it is the scariest thing you'll ever do, you'll never be nervous about anything else again.
Because
you've
done
the scariest thing. So then you go to meetings, you go out on a date, you know, you need to propose to your girl. You'll never get nervous again because your bar for what nervous means will change.
Okay.
You'll go, like, because I used to be such a nervous person when I was in high school and college. I started doing stand up. And then all of a sudden, it's like nothing shook me after that.
Yeah.
Because.
And then you became addicted to drama.
And then I'm an adrenaline junkie. Going on a roller coaster was like, I could take a nap. I think it's also a great way to figure out who you are and, you know, I think everyone should try everything.
That's what I imagined.
Yeah, it's because you can't be false up there. And I think a lot of times stand up, when you do it, it makes you realize how fake you are in real life, you know, because when you get up there, the audience will respond to the truth. So if you're not telling the truth,
they'll see through you.
They'll see right through you. Yeah. So it's good practice of just being authentic.
Well, again, the movie is called The Female Brain, out there in theaters Friday, February 9th. Whitney Cummings, thanks for joining me.
I hope that wasn't boring. Sorry if that was boring.
I'll take off my sleeping mask.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks again to Whitney Cummings for coming on the show. The Female Brain opens in theaters tomorrow, Friday, February 9th. For more information, visit ifcfilms.com. Order Whitney's very funny book, I'm Fine and Other Lies, on Amazon, and you can keep up with her at WhitneyCummings.com or on Twitter at Whitney Cummings. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.